From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Philadelphia's just started letting low-income water customers pay their bill based on income, not usage.
Water service is fundamental to life in Philadelphia and anywhere else.
But in Detroit?
Rather than moving to water affordability, what we're doing in Detroit is shutting off the water of tens of thousands of people and creating a public health emergency.
Wayne County Executive Warren Evans on changes wrought by the 67 Rebellion.
Today it makes a difference when you think about 67 is the changes in the police department from top to bottom.
And a UP ghost town with a mining history.
You have an old pump house, an old engine house, old boiler house, the remains of all those and the ruins. You can also still tour the mine.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Philadelphia lets the poor pay for their water based on income, not usage. Could the Motor City learn something from the city of brotherly love?
Water service is fundamental to life in Philadelphia and anywhere else. And we believe that low-income families deserve an opportunity to maintain that service at an affordable rate. That's what this program is really about at its core.
That comes up later this hour. But first, President Donald Trump is barring transgender people from serving in the military, in his words, in any capacity. He cited tremendous medical costs and disruption. Trump's announcement Wednesday morning on Twitter did not say what will happen to transgender people already in the military. The president's tweet comes as a coalition of 30 LGBT activist groups from Michigan pushes for clarification in the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. Specifically, what's the act saying in its existing ban on discrimination based on sex? Michigan Radio's Capitol reporter Shana Roth is with us now from our Lansing Bureau. Shana, break down the apparent fuzziness of this prohibition against sex discrimination in the Elliot Larson Act. Where's the uncertainty?
The uncertainty really centers around a small three-letter word, sex. For decades, it's had the more narrow definition of being just males and females, but our culture is changing, and these coalitions are saying, you know, that word in the Civil Rights Act doesn't just protect the sort of gendered version of the word sex, but it should also include sexual orientation and gender identity to include gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. But this is not the way the word has been interpreted in Michigan so much in the past. So it's left a lot of LGBT people feeling that they really have no redress against things like unemployment and housing discrimination. And that's what this coalition is really trying to firm up and get a clear answer on.
18 states have laws that specifically ban discriminating against somebody based on gender identity and sexual orientation. We are not one of those. So what is this coalition of groups actually asking of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission?
What they want is an interpretive statement clarifying what sex discrimination means. And to them, they believe that it should mean that it includes sexual orientation and gender identity. So it's kind of like guidelines.
Is this almost like an end zone run? Meaning if they got that, we wouldn't need to be as concerned about trying to get a law through the legislature that would do that?
So, Cindy, this is an administrative rule. That means it would not have the full force of law. However, it would cover how the Civil Rights Department handles these types of complaints for things like housing and employment. And these coalitions have been trying to get an actual law on the books specifically addressing this issue for years. Mm-hmm. But that just they just have not had any success in that in the legislature.
The political traction, they can't get that. Would this almost, in a sense, break the ice if they could get this this kind of declaration from the Civil Rights Commission? Might that kind of move the ball along a little bit further down the court?
Absolutely. It would be, you know, a sort of a step forward in that direction, in that, you know, now you have a state agency saying sex in the Elliot Larson Act does mean gender identity and sexual orientation. And what that would do is it would open up the doors for actually the Civil Commission itself to start taking cases of discrimination based on those accusations. It would also allow for more people who maybe have faced that type of discrimination to know, you know, hey, a state agency is saying this is something that I have a cause of action for. I'm going to go forward with this instead of just kind of, you know, throwing their case out there, spending all this money and really having no clear answer of where that could go.
Now, as far as this question, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission wants to hear from the public.
Yes, they do. They want to be as transparent about this as possible. They also say that, you know, they want to put landlords and employers on notice. So if this is something that is going to change or that this is something that they're going to address, they want those people that could be affected on both sides to be aware that that's a possibility. So everybody's being given a heads up on this. And really, they want to hear from people and employers and landlords, you know, everybody with a stake in this issue and hear what they have to say before going forward, because it is a big decision.
Well, how could someone weigh in? Do they go to the Michigan Civil Rights Commission website? Is there a link where people can go and file their comments?
If you go to the commission's website, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission's website, they have more information about it, including an email that you can send your comments to. Public comment has been open since yesterday at noon, and it's going to be open until August 15th. And then the commission is going to have a meeting on September 18th in Lansing, and that's when they will discuss this issue further and possibly make a decision.
Michigan Radio's Capitol reporter, Shana Roth. Shana, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The competition among Michigan and several other states has been fierce. The prize, Taiwanese firm Foxconn and its liquid crystal display plant. It appears Wisconsin will be winning the grand prize. President Trump is expected to announce today that new plant is going to Wisconsin, but Michigan may yet get a runner-up prize. Dustin Walsh of Crane's Detroit Business is with us now via Skype. And Dustin, as you and I talk right now, we're waiting for official word from what, the White House?
Yeah, that is right. We're waiting for the White House to confirm that Wisconsin is going to get the prize, which is the first liquid display plant. But the rumor is, or at least the speculation is, and what we're hearing from Michigan officials, is that there will be more than one. So Michigan is still in play.
And it is interesting, the announcement coming on the very day Governor Snyder was out in Rochester Hills signing the Good Jobs for Michigan tax incentive package. And that was really crafted to lure Foxconn to Michigan, wasn't it?
Yeah, that is correct. So the legislation is really designed to allow any Michigan company that's going to expand or relocate basically receive a 10-year 100% abatement on the personal income tax withholdings of their employees. But there was a special provision added specifically for Foxconn where it specifies any employer that creates 3,000 jobs or more will get a touch better rate on that.
And Foxconn is planning to build more than one plant in more than one state. So what might Michigan see as a consolation prize?
Well, it could be a very similar plant. We're not entirely sure. I mean, obviously, the 3,000 jobs written to the Good Jobs bill seems to be an indication of how many jobs they're looking to add. But we're not sure on the total investment. The ranges that have been out there have been anywhere from a couple billion to up to $5 billion, up to $10 billion. Like we believe the one in Wisconsin is going to be a $10 billion investment. Mm. So we're assuming something less than that here, but we're not sure exactly what it's going to look like.
And your story for Crane's Detroit Business kind of points us toward a possible location in Romulus, that some things are maybe already underway.
That is correct. From what we're hearing from sources, that they're already in discussions about permitting for water use, working with the local community colleges for a specific site in Romulus. We do not know what that site is going to be yet, but there were other places that were being thrown around, such as Lyon Township, a space out there. So we're not sure where it may land, but it does seem to be kind of toward that west side of southeast Michigan.
Now, you note in your piece for Cranes, Wisconsin has kind of seen these negotiations turn political. How's that happened? How is it playing out?
You know, it's some people are saying it's the Scott Walker effect, right? Scott Walker's playing into the hands of the president, and he's made a lot of job promises that haven't exactly come true in Wisconsin. So the idea of being able to just jumpstart 3,000 jobs, particularly with the president out there rallying for you, puts a big feather in his cap. But of course, the worry with the incentive package in Wisconsin, reports coming out of Milwaukee are saying that the incentive package could total $1 billion up to $3 billion. Which is almost unheard of a tax incentive package that large. So, you know, the worry is that you're giving away quite a lot to attract only a few thousand jobs. We're a little more insulated than that here in Michigan, and we haven't had quite the political pushback that they're seeing there. But it will be interesting how that plays out.
And as you point out also in your piece, Democrats have been basically kept in the dark, whereas here in Michigan, we saw, even though the legislative leaders were against the Good Jobs package, we saw bipartisan support and strength enough to clear the thing and put it on the governor's desk to sign today.
That's right. And we're seeing, you're seeing a lot of that. I mean, especially from the business community, you're hearing a lot about how Michigan just isn't competitive with its tax incentives, which is an interesting debate coming from both sides, because you're not quite sure where to rest on that. The argument is always that it's a race to the bottom, right? Every state's offering these incentive packages that are really just putting more and more pressure on the tax base. But you are in Michigan. We're seeing a lot of, there are more economic projects going on right now and more attraction going on right now, collectively, bipartisan even, than I've seen in my career. So it's kind of, which way do you look? You know, there's a lot going on. We just can only hope that the packaging that we're putting together with incentives is thoughtful and isn't going to put too much pressure on the taxpayers.
And as you point out in your piece, Foxconn left another suitor in the lurch in 2013, didn't it?
That's right. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, they had talked about, and this is a much smaller investment, they're talking about a $30 million plant there that would employ up to 500 people. But they had everyone on the economic team there rallying to get incentives put together, and then nothing ever happened. You know, we hope that doesn't happen in this case. It sounds like it's progressing a little further, but, you know, there's always that fear.
Dustin Walsh, Cranes Detroit Business, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All this week on our website, michiganradio.org, we are talking about teacher pay. Reporter Jennifer Guerra takes a deep dive look into how we pay teachers in Michigan and what it means for retaining teachers and teacher performance in the state. Check it out, michiganradio.org. Still to come, Wayne County Executive Warren Evans on changes wrought by the 67 Rebellion.
If we want to have one Detroit, it's got to include, I think, a lot more people than we're currently impacting.
That's coming up here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
It's recognized as the snow capital of the Midwest, which is quite a distinction for a town that no longer exists. It's Wednesday, time to talk our state's history. And today, we continue exploring the ghost towns of Michigan. Here with us today, our partner from the Michigan History Center, Rachel Clark. And Rachel, today we're going way, way up north, aren't we, to the Keweenaw Peninsula and the Upper Peninsula, focusing on what used to be Delaware, Michigan. To start out, where was Delaware?
Delaware sits right off M41 up in the Keweenaw Peninsula, so a little bit south and a little bit west of Copper Harbor.
All right. And what's its origin?
It is a mine town, or was a mine town. It originated as one of about half a dozen mines in that area. So it started in 1847, lasted until about 1887, producing copper. And so in that area, you get Pennsylvania mine, Minnesota mine, Wyoming mine, and Delaware mine.
Okay. So part of the big Upper Peninsula copper boom.
Yep, absolutely.
At its peak, at its glory days, just how big did Delaware get?
Delaware got pretty sizable for the area. The population grew from about 100 people to start in 1847 to close to, 1,000 people in its heyday. And at its highest production, it was pulling out 8 million pounds of copper total or mined in that time period. So it was sizable for the area.
And when would we say the heyday was?
About 1860s. A lot of different mining companies buy and sell these mines. And Delaware stays open for quite a bit of the time, but it really just isn't producing a lot of copper or a lot of money. It's really expensive to get the copper out of those mines. And so its heyday is in the 1860s, and then it just becomes, no matter how much money you throw at it, it's not pulling out enough copper.
So how long did it take the death cycle to last?
It was slow. In 1887 is the last bit of copper is pulled out of it. The mine town itself lasts for another 30 years-ish with men that are living there, but they're working in other mines. And as I said, Delaware was one of half a dozen mines in that area. So the other mines continue to run, but Delaware itself takes about 30 years of trying and hoping, and it just never comes back.
That is, it's a sad story and repeated so often. So it got just about 70 years of life, this town.
It did. It did.
So the final straw was the copper ended, and then around the town, is that what finally killed it, is the other mines gave out?
the other mines start to give out as well. And as I said, it's very difficult to get the copper out of those mines. The deeper you go and the tougher it is. Plus, they were pulling up a bunch of rock with it. So it's really expensive to process the copper out of that rock. And it took forever, but it just couldn't do it. Couldn't last.
Mm. So if people are driving, you know, to the Keweenaw Peninsula today, what would they see left of Delaware?
You have some old buildings. You have an old pump house, an old engine house, old boiler house, the remains of all those in the ruins. You can also still tour the mine, which I did many years ago with my husband. And it's a really cool tour. You get to go down about 100 feet to the first level, and you can see what the copper looks like when it's in the mine, and they talk about how miners mined it. There was a skunk there, a pet skunk that they owned, that I have a picture of my husband petting the skunk. They're really nice people, and it is a very cool tour, not only the mine tour, but the walking tour of the remains. Ooh. So you can go up there.
You have given me something, and I think a lot of us, to put on our travel list for Michigan. Finally, Rachel, what is the story behind Delaware, Michigan being dubbed the snow capital of the Midwest?
Keweenaw County Road Commission uses that site to hold the unofficial snow records of the UP. On average, they get something like 240 inches of snow a year from that spot. So that's just the location they've chosen.
That is fascinating. Well, we all have a new to-do thing on our Travel Michigan list, and we want to thank you for that. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark sharing the story of the Upper Peninsula mining ghost town of Delaware, Michigan. Rachel, as always, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan.
We looked down 12th Street and all you seen was fire and smoke.
Oh, the Motor City is burning.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street.
Chaos. Chaos. Just everywhere. People everywhere.
I said, this can't be happening to my city.
The madness overtook everything.
Anything in the world that Johnny can do.
The violence in Detroit in the summer of 1967 destroyed large swaths of the city, mostly in black neighborhoods, but it also energized the political ambitions of the city's African-American citizens. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, which opened just a few months before the trouble broke out, wanted to turn the black church into a political force in Detroit. Its founder, Albert Clegg, combined the church's history and civil rights activism with an emerging black nationalist movement. As the nephew of the Shrine's first leader, Wayne County Executive Warren Evans has a very unique take on how that summer of 67 changed the course of religious and political life for black people in Detroit. And Warren Evans had a front row seat to the chaos that broke out less than two blocks from his home.
I guess the main memory, I think I was about 17 or 18, I guess I ought to be able to do the math, was hunkered down in my grandmother's house, which was probably a block and a half from 12th and Claremont, where the riot or rebellion started. We were on Atkinson between 14th Street and LaSalle, and so was close enough to watch the tanks and, you know, be concerned about what was going on out there that you obviously couldn't see from your house. I mean, the golden rule in our household then is you're not going to leave the house until this thing's over, and there's no wandering around looking or taking pictures or anything else, a real concern about, you know, everyone's personal safety.
Did it feel surreal, I guess, like this is happening right here where I live?
Yeah, it did. And you know, coming from a family who was actively involved in civil rights and, you know, was not unused to concerns about the police and concerns about, you know, potential violence. I mean, we were not only hunkered down in the house, but hunkered down in the house to protect it if, in fact, you know, there were assaults on the house or that sort of thing. So, you know, you grow up quickly when you're 16 or 17 years old, sitting around the house in dark clothing, waiting for whatever confusion might have happened. Thank God nothing did. But, yeah, it's a quick maturation process, I think, in terms of life's realities.
So that was your perspective as a, you know, 16 or 17-year-old kid. What about your uncle? What about Reverend Albert Clegg? How did that week impact him?
I guess I would say that in many respects, it helped, in his mind at least, to help to emphasize that the concerns that the church and oftentimes, you know, black people in general had complained about were in fact real, and they were real enough for people to at some point say this is enough and kind of explode. It appeared to me that the mayor at the time was very, very surprised. It's kind of interesting. His son and I have been political rivals at different times. So this is how generational changes come. But I think it's safe to say that the mayor was very, very surprised that there was that level of discontent in the African-American community. And I think a lot of that was the fact that the people in the community that he talked to were not those generally impacted by the conditions. And so, while he had entrees into the black community, it wasn't at the neighborhood, walk the street level. And so I think my uncle was not at all surprised that this would happen. I think people in the city structure were very, very surprised that it did.
And of course, we're referring to Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh. And your uncle as an activist, I mean, he ran for governor of Michigan in 1964. Well, what was his campaign platform?
Freedom Now was the party, and I had several relatives that ran on that slate at that period of time. And it was a black self-determination issue. The expectation wasn't necessarily that you'd win. The expectation was that you'd be able to galvanize people of color throughout the state to see the issues in a couple of ways. One is, what's the urban agenda for black people? But also, back then, the very fact that you ought to be able to feel comfortable as an African-American voting for an African-American. It might sound strange to people today, but it wasn't overly strange then. There were people that would have been a foray into an area that they hadn't done before and didn't always have the confidence that that was something they should, could, or would do.
Reverend Clegg was a member of the New Detroit Committee. Longtime Michiganders may recall that was founded by Max Fisher, kind of designed to heal the many divisions in the city that this week exposed. But he left New Detroit. Why was that?
I think, the need to understand and acknowledge more quickly and more significantly the conditions or the plight of people of color in the city. And I think he was extremely frustrated at the slow movement. If you're an activist, a whole lot of dialogue doesn't go well for most of us. And so I think it was that, we're not moving fast enough. People aren't identifying the problem clearly enough. And I think it was more a protest with respect to that.
As you talked with your uncle following that week of rebellion, what did he feel was the main lesson from that week?
That people of color needed to work more closely together to help create their own institutions, to have their own support groups. And it certainly didn't mean not to interact with other groups, but the idea that you could have an African-American community and it could be viable, economically with respect to business, and you could have quality schools and those sorts of things were things that he believed were extremely important.
And 67 was the year that your uncle, Reverend Clegg, founded the Black Christian National Movement and renamed his church the Shrine of the Black Madonna. That was actually, am I right, before July of 67?
My recollection is that is so. I mean, the church had been going through a transition from a congregational church to the Shrine for, at a period of time. And, I'm always amazed that whatever churches there are, how much politics is involved in in churches. The church had been making, a transition for some time. It wasn't a quick sort of thing. And I think the rebellion or the riot exacerbated that movement to become more active and more vocal. And the church kind of morphed at that time.
And a greater black identity, stronger black identity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how was the Shrine of the Black Madonna? How did it become a force in reshaping Detroit politics after 1967?
Well, part of the whole kind of church experience is this issue of whether religion and politics can merge at some point in a way that makes sense. Obviously, the Shrine felt that it could and felt that without the political input and without the political strength, the social issues were not going to be moved on and were not going to be dealt with as significantly. And so the church formed an organization outside of the church called the Black Slate. And for many, many years, the Black Slate was a powerful force in endorsing and supporting candidates. Put a lot of people on the street in terms of poll workers, did a lot of community outreach to educate people on the issues, and many an elected official, including Coleman Alexander Young, had mentioned for years that they probably would not have been elected had it not been for the aggressive impact of the Black Slate.
And if you want to talk about a force of nature in reshaping everything about the city of Detroit, you just said that name, Coleman Alexander Young. What a force he was in the city's history.
Yeah, I think that's exactly true. I mean, I know he could be abrasive at times, and I think people overreacted sometimes to the things he said and did. But one of the things that I think is very, very hard for anybody to argue is he, today it makes a difference when you think about 67, is the changes in the police department from top to bottom. He was extremely instrumental in making sure that officers were recruited that more clearly represented the population of the city, and not just officers on the street, but the command structure. You know, there were ranking officers of color, not just officers on the street. And while, you know, color doesn't make you a good officer, it certainly helps to create a tenor for it not being an occupying army or being an employer that has people that, you know, that looks like it's citizenry. And I think that's made an awful lot of difference over the years. And I think when you look at cities that are powder kegs and have been in the last several years, one of the things you look to is, you know, how much does the police department look like the community it serves? And in virtually every one, there was a strong, strong underrepresentation of people of color and women. So I think that's an ingredient that is significantly different about Detroit. And I think it's, while, you know, we still have our problems and we have issues, I don't think the police community relations issue, generally speaking, is near as negative and intense as you'll find in many, many cities throughout the country.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Wayne County Executive Warren Evans as we review the 50-year mark, looking back at the impact of the summer of 1967. Something we're asking everyone, and I'm noticing you go back and forth too, riot or rebellion? What word speaks to you?
Rebellion, I think, because it's an attempt to respond to oppressive practices and things that are oppressive. I mean, but I certainly understand, you know, when property and businesses are destroyed, and you can't always make rhyme or reason out of that happening. I mean, the word riot is not, you know, a far-fetched term. I have been raised thinking about it in terms of a rebellion, but I'm not going to start a fight with anybody about which term we use.
When you think about where we are at this 50-year mark, clearly, as you point out, things are much better in the terms of policing in Detroit. Do you still see some of the same problems still lingering that led to that explosion in 1967?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the wealth disparity in the city today is significant. I mean, the city is rebounding and going places economically, but, I mean, there's a historical underclass there that hasn't seen benefit of any of this. And as long as you're starting to create, you know, more high-end folks and not doing anything substantial, and, you know, folks will argue about what's substantial for people at the poverty level, you are not alleviating the root causes of ongoing problems. And so that, along with, I think, an abysmally bad education system, are things that will be problematic until we get the foresight to get out in front of it and understand that, you know, when you talk about, you know, job development and workforce development and those sorts of things, when you're talking about people who have been chronically poor and poorly educated, that it's not just a program that you start at the corner. There are a bunch of social issues that need to be dealt with, you know, education clearly being one, mental health issues, substance abuse issues, to get many people in a position to be able to take advantage of opportunities that are there. So if we want to have one Detroit, it's got to include, I think, a lot more people than we're currently impacting. And that's not to say that the city isn't making valiant attempts to move in the right direction. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting that there's an awful lot more to do. And those of us who are realists understand that. And, you know, it kind of shades the progress a little bit because the progress has to be more global and has to be more intense. And those are the issues with respect to the city that I'm very, very concerned about. And quite frankly, some of our suburban communities that are in the same kind of shape. Mm-hmm. They're smaller, they're broke, the issues are the same. And opportunities have to be created to deal with those things. If that's attempted in a significant way, then people will buy in. I mean, people kind of understand the feeling of being empowered and not being empowered. And so when we make attempts like that, it's not necessarily that we have to employ everyone before people start feeling better. They start feeling better when they see opportunities and government looking at them in a little different light and saying, you know, you're customers too, and you're citizens too, and and we're going to try to do things to improve your plight.
Warren Evans is the Wayne County Executive. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Much more to come after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last year, more than 27,000 Detroit homes had their water shut off because of what the city says were unpaid bills. In some neighborhoods, one in five homes lost water access. It's the result of the cash-strapped city getting tough on people who can't keep up with paying their water bills. That push began in 2014. City officials predicted the shutoffs would taper down as people got themselves on payment programs and bills started being paid. But a Bridge Magazine report tells us residential shutoffs last year were up 18% over the previous year. Now, could the Motor City perhaps learn something from the City of Brotherly Love? This month, the Philadelphia Water Department launched a first-of-its-kind program in the nation, making water more affordable for low-income families. It's called TAP, the Tiered Assistance Program. Rob Ballinger is a senior attorney for the nonprofit Community Legal Services with us now from Philadelphia. Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. Glad to be here.
Tell us how TAP works, the Tiered Assistance Program.
If a low-income family completes an application and they're a customer of the department, they're entitled to bills which are calculated as a percentage of household income. If they owe any amount to the water department prior to enrolling in the program, that amount gets set aside. It basically gets frozen, and over a long period of time, it could be forgiven through continual payments under the TAP program. That's an area where we still believe we have some work to do. But as far as keeping the water on, a low-income family, anyone below 150% of the federal poverty guidelines, approximately $36,000 for a family of four, can get a bill that's calculated as either 2%, 2.5%, or 3% of their gross monthly income. That's all that family will have to pay for water, sewer, and stormwater service on a monthly basis. And for so long as they do so, they're not going to be asked to make any payment toward the amount that they owed prior to enrolling.
I'm wondering, what might a typical water bill be before someone gets on TAP compared to afterward?
The average household uses about 6 CCFs of water per month, and that totals approximately $70, $71, $72 per month under current rates.
Okay.
For example, that family were in the 100 to 150% of federal poverty tier and received $1,500 of gross income per month, then they would pay 3% of that amount. So if that family has a gross monthly income of $1,500 per month, that family would end up paying a $45 bill every month under this program. And of course, if that family had been asked to pay a substantially larger amount because they had debt prior to enrolling in the program, you know, that's really going to reduce the bill even further. So in a lot of cases, the families that we represent come to us with significant amount of backwater debt in the thousands and thousands of dollars sometimes. So when those families have an opportunity to not make a payment on that debt, as well as paying their current bills on a monthly basis, that's where the real savings is, right? Because if you have to pay $100 towards your debt plus an average bill of $70, $72, and what's really affordable to you is more like $45, well, where do you come up with the difference?
So this is a first of its kind in the nation because the water rate isn't based on how much you use, it's based on income.
That's right. We're not reinventing the wheel when we say that this is something new and innovative. It is in the context of water utility service. In the context of gas and electric service, in a lot of places, they have these kinds of programs already.
And it's just, I know, the first month of TAP. It just went into effect this month. Do you see this as an effective tool, not only for making the cost of water more affordable for low-income residents, but preventing shutoffs, preventing foreclosures?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We don't have data yet, but we know that from studies in the other utility industries in gas and electric, customers who enroll in affordable bill programs have higher bill coverage rates. That means they're paying more of their bills. So, I mean, we want to get people into the path of compliance. We want to get them in with service on and paying affordable bills. That's the alternative to really, you know, those dire consequences to losing your home to losing, you know, custody of your children, to risking your health and deteriorating your family. That's what's at stake. And we think this program is really the way to do it, to go about resolving those issues.
Rob, what do you think cities like Flint, like Detroit, that have issues with water and affordability could learn from this approach now that's being taken in Philadelphia?
The really important thing is to understand sort of how the problem originated. What we did here is we started to look through the rate-making structure at what was the collection rate on aging debt in the water system. What we found out was that the city's debt for water that customers owe that's more than 2 years old, which is the majority of that debt, is virtually uncollectible. When we set rates, we basically assume that's not going to come in the door. We're holding the debt. We're holding the customer responsible for the debt. But our rates are designed on a current basis to fund providing the service. So we sort of have a mismatch in terms of what we are trying to accomplish on a day-to-day basis with the utility and this lingering bad debt. That's what this program was about. It was about resolving that debt on a going-forward basis. It's not collectible, so it's just languishing out there as liens threatening people's property. If we can get into compliance, we can get more payments from those families on their affordable bills, and we can relieve the obligation, you know, relieve the problem that we have in the system of creating new debt. So I think in a lot of cities, that analysis may not be undertaken in the same way as it is in Philadelphia. That's one of the benefits of our rate-making structure, where we do go through basically an administrative trial to determine what water rates should be. We get to exchange a lot of information, do discovery, examine each other's witnesses, and really understand what the rates need to be going forward to maintain the essential service for all Philadelphians. And when you do that, you start to learn really about sort of what the problems are and how you can approach them differently than maybe you have in the past. That's sort of where this all kind of came from, in my view, is a real understanding of the problem of bad debt in our water utility. Other cities, I think, are looking to Philadelphia to see how this works for us going forward. I'm really excited to report on that when we have the data. We will have it. There's a reporting obligation in the statute that authorized this program, so we will get data on how the program is working. But in the meantime, I know Baltimore is introducing legislation similar to ours that may establish a similar type of program. I think there's an opportunity here to learn from this model, to see how it works, to apply it with those, you know, necessary changes that each community may have. There's no one size fits all, but the general framework is one that I think is really sound, and is one that I think will benefit a lot of people. The department estimates up to 60,000 families may be eligible for this program. That's a ninefold increase over the program that we've had for the last several years, which has benefited about 7,500 customers annually. That's a massive increase. We may not get there very quickly, but my expectation is we will help a lot more families in the long term.
Rob Ballinger, senior attorney with Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. The city has just launched a first of its kind in the nation program called Tiered Assistance Program, making water more affordable for low-income families. Rob, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cynthia. Enjoyed it.
Now we turn to Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer, who directs the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. Always good to have you here, Peter.
My pleasure to be here.
We've been learning about Philadelphia's TAP plan, first of its kind in the nation, basing payment for water, not on usage, but income. But didn't Detroit activists come up with something similar in 2003?
Yeah. For over a decade, people have been fighting for water affordability here in Detroit. And the actual structure and design of the Philadelphia plan is really an export from Detroit.
And what happened? Why wasn't Detroit the one to say, hey, we're first in the nation to have this kind of plan?
I wish I had a good answer to that. Any city that wants to meet the needs of its citizens would want to embrace water affordability. And yet, while the activists and a number of academics have been pushing for water affordability in Detroit for a long time, it hasn't gotten the political traction. There was a version of the plan, a very watered-down version of the plan that was adopted and never effectively implemented. And the Duggan administration is running as far away from water affordability as it can.
And my understanding is this plan would have actually increased city revenues.
Yeah, now this is the irony. So this is like one of these few times in public policy where you have a win-win-win scenario. So if you structure a water affordability plan correctly, and if you accommodate the notion that people have to pay for water based upon, in some respects, their ability to pay, it's a classic form of price discrimination, right? And any monopolist wants to be able to price discriminate, because if you can price discriminate, you actually have greater revenue. And when the government can implement a plan like that, it can get greater equity and greater revenue at the same time.
Considering we have nearly half of Detroiters living in poverty, how is there no appetite for a plan that could help people, could even increase city revenues and stop the turnoffs?
Yeah. And not only is there no appetite for that, there's a draconian policy of water shutoffs in Detroit. So rather than moving to water affordability, right, that would actually increase revenue in a very draconian way, what we're doing in Detroit is shutting off the water of tens of thousands of people and creating a public health emergency.
What is the Water Residential Assistance Program, WRAP, the Detroit program? What is it? How does it work?
Yeah, what you want to think about is a difference between affordability and assistance, right? What Detroit has tried to do is move to various forms of assistance, which are really Band-Aids. And the people at the Detroit Water and Sewer Department will admit, what they're trying to do basically is to subsidize a sinking ship by getting outside revenue, either through philanthropy or otherwise, in order to make up the gap between how much a person is charged and how much they can pay. You know, that's like bailing water out of a sinking ship. It doesn't address the core root cause of the problem, and it doesn't guarantee sustainability in the intermediate or long term.
So there's not a program in Detroit that tackles the affordability issue. It's let's get you right on the books with the city.
Yeah, but what it does then is that it's like these bad payment plans that you have for predatory lending is not sustainable. So people sign up for the plan, right? They might stay on it for a while, but if the underlying problem, as you've said, is that we have 40-50% poverty rate in the city of Detroit, at some point they're going to fall off that plan, and then they're going to be back in debt, and then they're going to have their water shut off again. So it's this cycle, right? This sort of a very tragic cycle. It doesn't get to the root causes. And if you don't get to the root causes of the problem, you're not going to have a real solution.
And when city officials say, well, people get advance notice of pending water shutoffs, and they say more than 90% of people whose water is shut off pay something, get on a payment plan within 24 hours and the water gets turned back on. What's the real story under that?
Yeah, first off, you always have to interrogate the public narrative. I've seen reports where they don't gather that data, right? So it's very hard to know that claim that X number of people get back on within X number of hours is actually accurate. I'd love to see the data, and then we can examine it. What I do know, though, is they don't say that over the long term, right? You can cash in to your friends and get loans and get, you know, assistance in an emergency, right? And that's what many of these people do. The water shutting off is an emergency, and people go into emergency action. At that point, then they might be able to gather the resources to make the payment to get on the payment plan, but that doesn't deal with the fact that they can't meet any of the other bills. In many respects, what you're saying now is I'm going to pay my water, but I'm not going to pay for my medicine or my food or my rent.
That's actually when I talked to Rob Ballinger from the Philadelphia Community Legal Services. He said, yeah, maybe they're paying it, but at what cost? Payday loans, whatever. And then you talk about the ripple effect with people losing homes or people at risk of losing kids. And I bet a lot of people hearing this narrative of water shutoffs in Detroit don't realize it goes beyond just I can't get water to brush my teeth.
No, and it's very important to know. There's a recent study by the Henry Ford Health System that showed that there's a direct correlation between water shutoffs on a block, right, and the incidence of waterborne illness and soft tissue infections. And that's what I say. What we really have is a burgeoning public health emergency, and we're not addressing the root causes of the problem.
And then people can lose their children if they're living in a home without water.
Yeah. So that, I mean, people can say, well, why aren't people talking about it? The minute a household that has children and it says that they don't have water, that's a predicate for losing their children, right? So you have this irony that the people who are being most affected are most in fear of ever coming out and talking publicly. And that's separate and apart from all the shaming that gets done on for people who have to admit that they're having trouble paying their bills. But if you look at systems and not individuals, what you have here is a convergence of all sorts of failed systems, the job system, the education system, the transportation system in Detroit, and it's our collective responsibility to have compassion and humanity in dealing with people who are stuck in those broken systems.
And I can hear you say, and feel free to say it, you're not hearing that humanity coming out of City Hall.
No, these are all values, right? The core question is, what is our value? Do we have a commitment to each other? And rather than having a compassionate commitment to the historic residents of Detroit, we've adopted all sorts of policies that focus on displacement. We've closed over 100 schools in the city of Detroit. We have over 100,000 tax foreclosures, and we have tens of thousands of people who have had their water shut off. That's not the society I want to live in.
And a payment plan doesn't address problems with people being unable to afford the water or people who were paying on time to landlords who didn't bother paying the water bill, but they didn't know that until they were punished by the water being shut off.
Yeah. And the key thing for your listeners to know is there's a huge difference between assistance and affordability. Affordability, which is the basis of the original Detroit proposal and what's going on in Philadelphia, leads to sustainability, right? Mm. Assistance is a Band-Aid. And the people at the Detroit Water and Sewer Department will admit that. They'll also admit, and I've seen this stated twice, in presentations that I've attended, that they don't even have the money on the assistance level to deal with half of the real needs, right? So we're providing assistance, which is a Band-Aid, and we don't even have enough money on assistance to deal with the scope of what the real needs are.
Could we take that Philadelphia program, the TAP plan, and put it into effect here in Detroit?
If we had the will. Now, I mean, I wanted to raise the issue of the Headley Amendment, which is what the Water and Sewer Department, the mayor, beat everybody's head over when they hear about affordability. You can structure a plan of affordability that could meet the Headley Amendment.
And break down what that, to refresh everyone's memory.
The Headley Amendment talks about the difference between a fee and a tax, and if it's classified as a tax, it says that it has to be subject to a public referendum. Right. And any good lawyer, right, if you went to a law firm, right, if we actually went to Jones Day and said, solve a problem for us, good lawyers could help us design a plan that could meet the requirements of the Headley Amendment. It's also possible to design plans that don't. But the question is there political will? And secondly, even if it did trigger the Headley Amendment, why don't we have a public referendum? Why don't we take this to a vote? So there's all sorts of legitimate paths forward. And what we have, rather, is people who are slamming these doors and making excuses on why we're not going to act in a humanitarian fashion.
Talk to those listening who see this pretty much as a problem of people who just don't pay their bills. How is this a civil rights issue?
Yeah. No, the key thing is that we often use debt to have forms of social control. Right. And the best example I would say is go back to sharecropping. Right. Sharecropping was a system that guaranteed that I kept people in debt and in their debt had them under my control. Right. And I would suggest, and this is not said enough, that what we really have, and you can think about emergency management, you can think about the bankruptcy plan of adjustment, you can think about the water shutoffs, is exactly that same kind of dynamic of using debt as a means of social control. The minute I can frame it as debt, I have three millennium of moral shaming that makes the individual and not the system responsible. I would also compare the water shutoffs with the tax foreclosures. There was a good New York Times editorial over the weekend, and there's been good research that shows the tax assessments have been radically overassessed, illegally overassessed, and people have been losing their homes for unlawful assessments. And yet the same frame is applied to the people with the tax assessments, right? You don't pay your taxes, you shouldn't have your home. And I have to say, we have to look at the dysfunctional systems, and we have to look at individuals stuck in dysfunctional systems, and we have to come back compassionately with holistic, sustainable solutions to those problems.
Peter Hammer is a professor at the Wayne State University School of Law, where he directs the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. Peter, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
We asked the director of Detroit's Water Department for an interview. So far, Gary Brown's office has not responded to our request. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.